And welcome to the Taylor Report. I like that pause. It's very dramatic. It says CIUT 89.5 FM. And with me is Phil Condon. How are you doing,
Phil? Good afternoon, Phil.
So we got some a lot of material today. We have, we're going to be speaking to Scott Taylor, espritdecor.ca. And Scott Taylor is on top of the matters, such as the friendly fire matter. And later we will talk to Ann Garrison about the political prisoner, Victoire Ingabire, held in Rwanda. There was an important article in Weekend Star to give you a picture of the type of regime that is holding her. And in the latter half of the program, we will be talking to Zafar Bangash on some of the same issues, what is going on in the fighting in Iraq, Syria, the whole region, and ISIS, and or IS, or Daesh. You can take your choice of the how you want to describe these people, since nobody seems to know them anyhow. You may as well take be your own namer. This is the Taylor Report. You can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. And three items in all today. And we'll tell you, too, by the way, there's going to be a book launch at the a different book list on April the 9th. Am I right?
Well, it'll be at Betzatoon, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. Betzatoon.
Good. On April the 9th at 7:30.
April the 9th at 7 p.m. And we are joined now, I believe, by Scott Taylor of espritdecor.ca. Are you there, Scott?
I am here, yes.
Hey, Scott, we're really glad to be talking to you. And by the way, I'll bet you're very, very popular these days because everybody wants to know, they want you to sort out the nomenclature of these various little strange episodes that have happened. We've lost a sergeant and three wounded, and the incident was called friendly fire. I just occurred to me that friendly fire is kind of an odd word. If you have people training people, which is, I understand, what they were doing in this part of Iraq, they weren't going to be in fire. So how could it be friendly fire exactly?
Well, this is where, I mean, you're right, people are trying to get their heads around Iraq, and it's a very complicated, complex situation, which, you know, the little bits that we hear, we know that they've deployed, and we said they were going to be strictly in a training mission. People are asking, you know, of course, after all these years in Afghanistan, people seem to know more about the military, so they're a little bit more clued in, and they were asking, look, I mean, we're sending over fighter aircraft, and we have good people on the ground, or special forces, will they be lasering targets to pinpoint for pinpoint accuracy? And very specifically, we were told that would not be the case because that would constitute combat. And, of course, then we found out that our soldiers had been under fire, sniper fire and mortar fire, as a result of doing just that, lasering targets up on the front lines. Mm-hmm. So that was came to light, but it didn't seem to affect the government's position. They sort of backtracked and said, look, the mission evolved, and they just didn't think to tell anybody. And then this incident, we were told, again, they're aiding and assisting. Aiding and assisting means occasionally going to the front lines, but it's not clearly not mentoring, which we all knew from Afghanistan meant that you went with the troops. We all, you know, the more that we learn about this, I mean, it becomes a bad thing for them, right? It's like all these different words.
Mm-hmm.
But we were not mentoring. We were not with a unit whereby we were taking leadership role like we did in Afghanistan to sort of get these troops sorted out.
Mm-hmm.
But the training involved occasional visits to the front lines, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're supposed to believe, some of these things that we're supposed to believe, that were fed out to CBC's Peter Mansbridge on the condition of anonymity, was that these guys had gone through two checkpoints that night, that they were expected, that they had made arrangements to go forward, and the password was to be a phrase in Arabic. Now, Kurds speak Kurdish.
Oh, my God.
Canadians speak English. Why would they agree upon a phrase in Arabic when the enemy speaks Arabic and you're on the front line? Like, that would have to rank.
Perhaps to cover somebody's ass in Ottawa. I don't know.
Well, they keep trying to cross off these T's and dot the I's as far as making sure that we know through Peter Mansbridge, taking this anonymous source, that everything we did was perfectly fine because, of course, we've got the Kurds saying that we showed up unannounced, responded in Arabic when they speak Kurdish and there was no prearrangement, and they opened fire. And then the only sort of positive that we were to take away from this anonymous, highly placed source was that our soldiers very professionally did not return fire, and that's, of course, after they were hit by numerous bullets. Everyone in the patrol was knocked to the ground,
mm-hmm.
And then they chose not to fire back. Well, that's not a huge plus, I would say, for the Canadians. Not returning fire in a friendly fire, sure, I mean, it shows discipline, but if you're already all hit,
yes,
it makes the decision very easy. But it's
Well, by the way, I didn't know this had been confirmed about the peculiar idea of how to communicate at a guard post. So they are. It seems they're now we're going to agree that the Arabic was used.
They have put this out there, and this is something which, I mean, I was at a PPCLI regimental birthday on Friday, and the people there were all shaking their heads. I mean, for us, I mean, in the infantry, everyone knows that passwords are based on phonetic alphabet. Usually it's two letters as a challenge, like Tango Alpha, mm-hmm. and then your reply would be Romeo Oscar or Quebec November. It was the two letters that change usually every 12 hours. And it's passed on to the troops. You know what the challenge is. You know what the response is.
Well,
not some Arabic phrase when you don't speak Arabic, and, yes. and the enemy does. Like, it would make no sense that would have been something they agreed upon. But that was something which the government started putting out there as early as last Sunday morning, that there had been a password, and the Kurds were saying we spoke Arabic. And so to sort of blend the two, they've come up mm-hmm. with this story, which, again, it's an unattributed anonymous source, which... In the world of journalism, I mean, you shouldn't just go with that when it's just all too pat.
Well, we are having a problem, as you point out. The mission apparently is not the mission that people thought it was, and then we have an episode where we can't get the story straight. I mean, we not only have a fog of war, we seem to have a fog of journalism and people trying to cover their errors or their brilliant maneuvers. I don't get it, but...
I mean, again, for me, like the bigger picture stuff is that, you know, whether we were 200 meters behind the front line, which, I mean, is ridiculous. Like, most even heavy mortars have got more than a 200-meter lethal range upon impact. So how would you be safe if you're back there? I mean, this isn't a continuous line that you're standing back. You know, there's the line, and I'm 200 meters behind it.
Yeah.
Approaching from the rear.
In school, we said, I've got kings. I'm 200 meters away. You can't shoot me.
Right. And this is, the Kurds who were on the front line that were there, they're saying that was actually a planned ambush, and the Canadians drove into it, planned for ISIS, of course, but we didn't know that. But I mean, they would have felt or thought they were on the front line because they know the area, and they were there. I mean, they saw what appeared to be an enemy. I mean, of course, again,
and it's night. It's at night,
and you're hearing voices. We all know that ISIS forces have an awful lot of foreign volunteers, mm-hmm. even from Canada and from Europe. And then you've got a guy speaking Arabic, which is the core language of the Sunni Arabs that make up ISIS. So if you've got that blend of voices...
That would be the language of the enemy.
And you're a Kurdish guy sitting there that's just watched videos of people being burnt alive in cages and having their heads cut off.
Mm-hmm.
I'd probably open fire, too.
Well, actually, I grew up in a neighborhood where World War II veterans said to each other, shoot first and ask questions later.
And I'm sure they would never have organized with a Norwegian ally to have German as the password when they were coming back from patrol. It just defies logic.
Well, by the way, how about liaison? I mean, ordinarily, these are not, they don't speak Kurdish, they don't speak Arabic, as far as I know, these special ops guys. So ordinarily, I would assume they would have a liaison man with them to handle these issues.
Well, there's some pretty basic phrases, which are, I mean, even though they're common to Arabic and Kurdish, and Askar, which because of the Ottoman Empire, Askar means soldier. And Kanadi means Canadian. So Askar Kanadi. You can scream that out. I mean, why they needed their translator after they've been there for 5 months, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that should have been probably a better recognition symbol than yelling something out in Arabic.
Yeah.
But
did you hear what I mean, that issue of, I heard there was a vehicle and a second vehicle arrived and shouted to them to stop. Or are they claiming that the driver was in the vehicle with the Canadians and he's the one who shouted?
It sounds like they had a driver interpreter that was, for some reason, they had an Arabic translator driver that was there, and he was the one that shouted for them to stop firing, probably the phrase I just said, Askar Kanadi. But again, I spent a lot of time in northern Iraq. I mean, probably spent...
Some of it you didn't care to spend. You were a hostage.
Yeah, and that was even after I'd been there 20 times. I still didn't quite get all the nuances. There's many pitfalls, mm-hmm. but I mean... When you're hearing people talk about either the town of Kirkuk or the north, and they don't mention the Turkmen, they mention the Kurds, but the Turkmen represent about 2 million people up there. You've got Yazidis, you've got Syrian Christians, Chaldean Christians. People aren't even mentioning that. They don't even understand the complexity and the fact that the Kurds are divided by tribes. They're divided by a Sunni-Shiite split in their religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the north. And then you're looking at the rest of it in terms of the Shiite militia that were stood up as opposed to the Iraqi army that collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
Not wanting to represent the central government. The central government is so weak, it's unbelievable. They've now got Iranian generals leading Shiite militia against the town of Tikrit.
Yeah, a glamorous Iranian is running the whole show.
Yeah, and this is, we can't give them any credit for any gains that they've made, which have been tenuous at best, but we're not bombing in support of them because we have declared Iranians to be evil, so we know ISIS is evil. So it gets very complicated, and that's where, when we say we're bombing against ISIS, no one in position of power in Canada is telling us about the mission. Who are we fighting for? What is the end day going to look like? Mm-hmm. If there's no real strong central government in Baghdad now, the Kurds have no intention of going back underneath that. They've now captured from Iraqi security forces that when ISIS appeared, they took advantage of that, and they captured the oil fields in Kirkuk. I mean, these guys are pretty opportunistic. Mm-hmm. They want to create their own state, and they want that state to include land and population in four neighboring countries, which includes Syria. Of course, they've already got that. Mm-hmm. And there are a huge chunk of Turkey, Armenia, mm-hmm. and Iran. So this has got the potential to destabilize, I mean, five other countries. I mean, this is crazy.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking of Scott Taylor, the Esprit de Corps.ca, and every Canadian ought to be going to that site, as a matter of fact. There was a Globe and Mail story, which seemed sort of a head-scratcher. It said that the Prime Minister had spoken to the Prime Minister of Iraq, and the Prime Minister of Iraq had expressed condolences. But you just been eloquently telling us the guy you might want to talk to is the leader of the Kurdish region, and I haven't seen any record there of his of any conversation about condolences. Have you?
No, they keep on saying it was our fault. They had a, CBC had a Kurdish general on last night, showing how they were on the front line and that they were not where they were supposed to be, and he was adamant that it was the fault of those victims that the Kurds had engaged. The Kurds have really no, I mean...
We can't get them to stay on the same story, same page with the brass here.
No, then they keep saying, Nicholson, the foreign minister, said that there's no rift in relations between the Canadians and the Kurds over this. And it's like, well, that's wonderful, except we are the ones who should be the angered party because they killed our soldier and wounded three more.
And why not withdraw until all this is straightened out?
Well, this is it because the government is now so far entrenched. We've been going this route. We've been supplying weapons to the Kurds. We've been going in to supply them training. The truth is they don't want our training. These guys, and I've mentioned this in other interviews, I mean, they love our kit. They love the weapons that we've got. They want that to improve. They all think that they're good soldiers themselves. They've been fighting this fight either against various other Kurdish factions or against Saddam.
Well, they are good fighters, aren't they? You saw them yourself.
They're not that disciplined, and that's the thing is we're coming in there. We're saying, look, we're going to make you march in step, and we're going to teach you how to be an army, a Western-style army. But they're like, that's not how we fight around here, right?
Not the way we roll.
No, we change flags. We deceive everybody. We switch sides. This the history on this. Even during the era after the first Gulf War in 1996, when the Kurds were in their own autonomous region, Masoud Barzani cut a deal with Saddam, and he brought his tanks up and helped him crush his rival, Jalal Talabani, which gave Barzani control of Erbil in return, Saddam was able to crush the CIA network in the north. Mm-hmm. Now, this is at a time when people, like, they shouldn't have even been talking. I mean, they should have been so furious with each other, but they cut deals. And that's what we need to know about these Kurdish leaders. While it may be Masoud Barzani and Jalal Talabani may be politicians, if you look at that Kurdish regional government, almost everybody in that network is named either Barzani or Talabani. It's a nephew of, it's a grandson of, it's, I mean, you name it. It's two...
Yeah, Harper stands out in that conversation.
Well, it's the fact that they've got positions where he's the finance minister or the foreign minister, but it's like, okay, so we're back to, it's not a democracy. And just before the last election, I think it was 2010, longtime rivals Talabani and Barzani got together and said, look, if people vote for different parties, we could be ousted. So together they formed a super party, kind of like all the villains in Chicago decided, look, run the one party and we'll get elected.
Yeah.
And they took like 98% of the votes and they got all the parties, all
and
the seats.
All the buses run on time.
But this is not, I mean, you can say it's the democratically elected government of Kurdish region, but the fact is, if you start to peel back those layers of the onion, you realize, no, this is the same old game.
Yeah.
And they will still have their own petty rivalries, but it's now under their own control, right?
Yeah. This is Scott Taylor, EspritDeCorps.ca. By the way, Scott, I really congratulate you. I watched the video that's on the site there. You brought up a subject kind of important, and you referred to it earlier. You say they have martial pride. I wish people would remember that when they give press conferences here and talk about how we got our guys and their pride, but other soldiers have pride. So if you talk about we were superior, they're inferior, that explains the whole problem. That's not very smart.
Well, and again, you've got to figure these guys, the Peshmerga, they walk around, they strut around in their villages. They've got the Kalashnikov, and they've got the pistol on the hip, and they've been around, and the village girls look at them and admire them for their courageousness, etc. And then all of a sudden, our guys show up, and they're 6'2", they've got body armor on galore. They look like RoboCop. They've got all this technologically superior equipment and vehicles. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, the Peshmerga guy doesn't look so yeah. powerful, right? We are the new power in town.
I can smell a problem there.
It's going to be, yeah. And it's, you know, just the way that they get looked at. And then we're telling them that we're here to teach you discipline.
Yeah.
We're going to yell at you and
good luck with that.
Make you do push-ups. It's like, no.
Hey, can I ask you one other apropos of that in winding up? Is these guys are called special ops. They're not in the training business, are they?
No, they're fully trained. And there's people out there saying, former commanders, like they should be out doing manhunt or sniping or going after it. But the problem is we don't speak the lingo. We haven't been there long enough. We don't have any kind of historical roots into this part of the world.
Yeah. Mortars, small arms, grenade launchers, that's basic training. That's not special.
And we don't need guys to be of their caliber to be teaching these guys how to go sneak and peek around an area that they know all too well. I mean, that's
the... No, the idea would be send a couple guys to learn from them, right? How do these guys do it? Particularly night fighting.
Did we send guys to learn from the Afghans about what? You know, they managed to defeat every empire ever thrown at them, and we never went to send anybody and said, well, how do you do that? We went in there and said, we're going to teach you how to fight. And they're like, are you serious? We taught Alexander the Great how to fight.
Yeah. By the way, you've touched all the points. Your articles are terrific. Canadians must know the end game before the mission to Iraq is extended. I don't think it could have been put better for the Canadian public. Scott Taylor, we really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Take care.
Scott Taylor, espritdecorps.ca. And you're listening to Taylor Report. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. We're on the web, taylor-report.com. And